Welcome to the QuokkaCast, featuring special people just like you. So let's join our host, the Agile Quokka, as we meet another amazing person in this episode, and let's quokk about it.
Hey there, QuokkaCast listeners. I have a bonus episode for you, and this bonus episode was actually recorded in October of 2021, so a few months back, but Jeff Watts zoomed in from his Cheltenham studio to spend some time in a great conversation with me, and it was such a delight. So I'm excited that we finally have an opportunity to get this released here on the QuokkaCast. It was also intended to go out for the Becoming a True Agile Leader podcast, where I was guest hosting. It might still appear there at some point. So hey, two for the price of one, right? Well, Jeff Watts is the founder of Inspect and Adapt Limited. He's got a great website you should check out there. I can personally testify that he's just a great professional coach, very gifted. He's so down to earth. He's highly inspirational as a thought leader and a mentor. I just benefit daily and multiple times a day from Jeff Watts and all that he does. He is a best-selling author. He's an award-winning author of books like Scrum Mastery, Product Mastery, Team Mastery, and in between of that trinity of sorts, he even gave us a book called The Coach's Casebook that he co-authored with Kim Morgan. Jeff is a global keynote speaker and without a doubt, one of the most respected and experienced agile and leadership coaches all over the planet. So, without further ado, I hope you enjoy this fun and delightful episode that I had with one of my coaching heroes, Jeff Watts. Check it out. Welcome to you, Jeff Watts, and thank you so very much for saying yes to appear on the podcast with us today.
Well, thank you for that welcome. I think that's going to go down as my nicest introduction ever, I think, Jeff. Thank you.
Oh, super excited to have you with us. So, We mentioned your books there, Jeff. I should also just dive right in to also say there's another book out there that I'm familiar with, at least. And this book is called Organic Agility Foundations. It's something of a handbook, as I understand it, for leadership and organizational theory and practice. And I understand you had some sort of a hand in co-authoring this one as well, or contributing to it in various ways. So I thought we'd start off talking about some of the themes that appear in that work. I know a lot of that also is repeated in some training courses that you make available. So I'm sure we'll get a chance to touch on that. So let's start maybe with the first theme that leapt out to me in the book. It was this sense of organizations needing to be much more intentional about how they support internal leadership growth. Mm-hmm. And what I saw that as is sort of this juxtaposition with what might be out there is maybe a flawed mindset that some people are just natural born leaders. And it's up to HR departments or what have you to find them, or it's up to people internally to just identify the natural born leaders and place them into those positions of rank and leadership. So tell us a little bit, what would you say, what would you recommend right now to corporate leaders, corporations, what are you maybe even telling them about how to invest more in actually develop, growing, cultivating their leaders within?
So the whole organic agility approach came about really because myself and quite a few other people, Andrea Tomasini, Dave Snowden of the Kinevin Framework, we were sort of frustrated with basically the options that organizations and leadership teams of organizations had when it came to trying to adopt the principles of agile delivery at anything bigger than just the team level, looking at the organizational culture to support agility. And the whole idea of taking a very predictive approach to ultimately an iterative incremental culture didn't really sit very right. So we looked at that, and as well as from a process perspective, in terms of, yes, how do we do our work and how do we build our products and so on? There's a huge element of what's leadership in this world, in this situation. And the dominant metaphor that most of our organizations have been built on over the last 100 years was perfectly good, but isn't necessarily as relevant now. So that dominant metaphor, which is effectively, we get a set of inputs and we will work out how we can efficiently turn them into a product using a kind of mechanical process.
Right.
Very, very efficient. Was served a great purpose, but that's very difficult to do now. We're pretty much all well aware that the predictability is significantly lower than it used to be. The rate of change is much higher than it used to be. The rate of complexity, levels of complexity, is a lot higher than it used to be. So we needed a new, more organic metaphor that allowed us to be more responsive, allowed us to be more resilient and more effective rather than being efficient. And of course, as well as changing the way that we work, that requires a different kind of leadership. And what we've found over the last 15 years, 20 years or so, is that it's not about shifting from being X kind of leader to Y kind of leader. It's more a case of being flexible in how you lead based on the context you find themselves in. So, you know, I used to be of the belief that we needed to be a much more agile organization. And my view of agile leadership was pretty much predominantly being a servant leader. And I think that was a little bit naive, maybe, but also to be expected, if you like it. When you shift from one extreme, you often go too far the other way. So this idea of contextual leadership, you had a question. What would I say to leaders to become more willing to invest more of their time to improve their leadership development? I don't really find that as much of a challenge as one might think, because most of the organizational leaders that I speak to are constantly thinking about their leadership. They're constantly asking themselves, how can we get better? And they're aware that it's a lot more nuanced than it used to be. Mm. And unfortunately, when people come through the ranks, they get promoted for what they're good at and what the company values. When there's a match, then they generally tend to progress. But that's out of date. So quite a lot of leaders that I work with have been promoted because they knew a lot. They could get stuff done. They could solve problems. They could answer questions. And now they find themselves in a position where actually knowing the answers isn't really an option for them. And they feel a little bit lost, a little bit vulnerable, and they know something different needs to happen, but they can't rely on their previous strengths. So it's not so much convincing people that they need to think about things differently. It's giving them a bigger set of tools so that they can be more effective in more circumstances.
Right.
And not just, like you said, a really good point, not just the traditional hierarchical leaders, because in a more resilient organization, we need greater levels of autonomy. We can't wait for decisions to be escalated up the chain and then pushed back down again. We need the people who know what to do or who have the skills to figure out what to do to be empowered to make those decisions. But that requires them to take on the level of leadership at various points. So it's not a case of, right, you are a good leader, you don't have the capacity to be a leader. It's kind of taking the view that everybody has the potential to be a leader, but a different kind of leader when the situation calls for it.
Yes, yes. Thank you. And what also struck me in that Organic Agility book was, I think it's the use of archetypes. Would that be fair to call them that? I think is how the book says, is equipping people, as you say, people can be various types of leaders, these different types, and it's helping with the awareness of maybe what type of leader you are in a certain context, but if your context changes, how to become something different. Am I on the right track with that? Would you want to say something else about that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of people, when I started talking about these leadership archetypes a few years ago, I think a lot of people were a bit surprised, because one of the things that I was saying is that actually command and control leadership is not bad. It's not good. It's not bad. It's either appropriate or not. It's either coherent or it's not coherent. And there will be certain times within any team development, with any organizational development, with any level of product development, when actually people are looking for somebody to say, tell me the answer. Tell me what to do. You know, I know that you know. Okay. I don't know. Tell me. And if I were in that position and somebody was screaming out to me saying, tell me the answer, and I knew the answer, and they knew that I knew the answer, but I responded with more of a coaching style. So what do you think we should do? And what would you like to try? That would just lead to real high levels of frustration, or what we tend to call now motivational debt.
Mm.
Because the form of leadership the leadership archetype that I'm providing isn't what's being asked for or what's needed in that context. Of course, in a very volatile and complex environment, there will be fewer and fewer opportunities where that is appropriate, and more opportunities where actually as a leader, my job isn't to tell people what to do. It is to help people figure out the answer and provide the environment to help them do that. But that's it still is a case-by-case basis.
Yes, absolutely. I wonder what you think. I'm finding in my experiences and the experiences of others around me that sort of the day-to-day pressures of just trying to get work done, trying to process whatever seems to be the most important priority, or maybe it's the fact that there's too many things that have been described as equal priority. And so it's the decision-making struggles that are happening, right? But more to the point is I'm sensing people don't even realize how to stop and slow down and take a moment to figure out what contextual situation is happening to them in that moment. Yeah. And how to kind of level set what it is that they need in terms of a type of leadership and a type of decision-making and so forth. And I guess to go a little bit further on that question or point or observation that I'm making in this is I currently see coaches as being critical to provide that, to sort of help everyone slow down, pause, reflect, and get reoriented, and then to kind of move in a more productive way from there. I guess that's my question to you, though. Am I naive in my viewpoint on that? Would you say that it's more, even more nuanced? What else would you recommend for leaders to kind of do for their people who feel stuck so much at work and struggling to get out of that sense of being jammed up?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really insightful observation. Personally, I've yet to go to an organization where they haven't been doing too much concurrently. And actually, in order to deliver more value, they need to stop doing some things. And that idea of slowing down, stop doing stuff so you can get more stuff done, that sort of counterintuitive point. And that's something that if you speak to any one individual within that organization, they probably say we're doing too much stuff. But it's not a conversation that's usually had organizationally because they feel, well, we just can't stop things. That's just not something that happens here. So from a leadership perspective, providing evidence, role modeling the ability to stop something, to say not yet instead of yes, to be able to say, yes, this is important, but not quite as important as these things. And if we say yes to all of them, we're killing our opportunity to deliver on any of them. That role modeling is absolutely critical because actions speak a heck of a lot louder than words when it comes to doing something that vulnerable, that potentially professionally and personally risky.
Mm, yes.
So coaches do play a really valuable part in that because they can make it visible, but they don't have the authority and they shouldn't have the authority to make those decisions. It should be leadership's decisions. So I guess what I'm reading into your question there is, well, why, if leaders do see that, they do know that either intuitively or personally, why aren't more of them acting like that? And I think for me, there's an element of self-preservation and there's also an element of conflicting incentives. So there are so many, an organization is a complex adaptive system. There are so many things intertwined. So me as a leader, I've got, as well as the people that I'm looking after, as well as the objectives that I've got, the targets that I've got, I've got my career to think about. I've got political relationships to think about. You're looking at a leadership team, for example, and a couple of those people on that leadership team probably thinking about, well, when the CEO leaves, it might be me next. So I can't afford to drop the ball. I can't be the one to say, I can't do this. That element of trying to show strength through almost machismo, if you like, when it comes to work, is still prevalent in a lot of organizational cultures. So these intertwined things will make it very, very difficult for that to happen. The incentives that are in place will often lead to dysfunctional behavior and quite strange behavior in many ways.
Yes. Yes, that's so helpful and insightful how you describe that. So something as you were
helping us understand that, something that struck me was, again, thinking about this organic metaphor, and in my mind, hearing some other people talk about leadership today is more like trying to be a gardener, trying to cultivate. And I think it's what Lisa Adkins and others are even talking about, kind of that shift from the mechanistic over to like a rainforest analogy for that complex adaptive system of the enterprise. So I'm thinking about that. I'm not much of a horticultural person myself yet, but I am aware of kind of what it takes to prune back, you know, trees, shrubs, other things to improve their health, to grow again and to create more blooms, blossoms, fruit. And I'm thinking about something I heard you say recently, the etymology of the word decision. Yeah. So that's where I'm trying to bring this back is, I wondered if you might want to expound a little bit on the etymology of decision-making and that word decision and sort of this cutting off and sort of, what you would recommend for us as evolving leaders right now on how to be more willing to say no, to cut something off.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, so I was only introduced to this etymology of the word decision recently, and it's basically saying the decision part of the word is to say is cut. And the idea behind that is that by making a decision, you are cutting off other options. Now, I was brought up in my agile education to try and keep your options open as much as possible, you know, the last responsible moment, things like that. But also, almost any decision is reversible, is changeable, is improvable. So if you can make some decision and then make it better, but if it is going to be catastrophic and you don't have to make it, then don't make it. And this is the challenge that ultimately a lot of leaders have to handle, because there will be times within an organic organization when you are being an effective organic leader, as it were, where there is a need to be more decisive. But there's also a time when there is a need to be less decisive. And there is a time when actually you don't want to make a decision. You want to let the information make the decision for you. And being able to be comfortable in all of those domains. Now, most people will be comfortable in one of those domains and not in the other. So there are people out there that love making decisions. Yeah, you know them. You're going out for a meal. Someone will say, well, let's go here. Mm-hmm. And someone will say, I don't mind. Wherever you want. I'll go with wherever. Okay. Well, let's see what happens. Let's see what's open. Let's turn up and see what's there. And neither is right or neither is wrong per se, but there are times when it's absolutely critical that we make a decision, and there are times when it's absolutely critical when we don't. There are times when it's absolutely critical that somebody else makes a decision and not us. So what I'm doing with leaders is trying to help them get more aware of the context. And generally doing that through reflecting on stories of success and failure. Not that I would judge success or failure, but that they would judge success or failure. So looking back at decisions or outcomes and saying, well, how did that turn out? And was that down to luck? Okay, because sometimes you can have a good decision that leads to a bad outcome. Doesn't mean it was a bad decision. Sometimes you can have a bad decision that leads to a good outcome. Just plain old luck. But if you can think, oh, that wasn't lucky, that was the right call, and it was the right outcome. Why was it the right call? What made it the right call? And if I can start looking at some of those benchmarks and capturing my own patterns, then I can start doing a little bit more like that in this context and a little bit less like these ones that didn't work in these contexts. I'll stop there because I think I might have gone off track a bit.
No, I loved it. So something that came to mind as you described that was, and let me try to phrase it as a question. So when you're coaching leaders, helping leaders, what I heard you suggesting is in your conversation with them, your coaching or mentoring type conversation, that you're having them retrospect on past experiences, where judgment was involved and decision-making was involved, and self-assess, evaluate, improve their awareness of what their experience was. And I'm hearing from that they improve maybe in levels of awareness, confidence, to sort of move forward into future decision making with you know, feeling better equipped to do that. Let's say more agile, more nimble in the mental needs that they would have to make those decisions in the future. How did I do?
Yeah. I think you captured that really, really well. And I would add an extra dimension to this, because it is actually, as we become more organic as an organization and leadership is spread throughout the organization, more autonomy is spread throughout the organization to allow us to be more responsive. So everyone within the organization needs to be making similar coherent decisions. Now, we can't standardize actions in a complex, fast-changing environment. But we might be able to standardize how we make those decisions. Yeah, so the thought process that goes into them. So if we can say, well, in this kind of context, this is the kind of decision that we would make. This is the kind of decision-making process we would go through. So as well as that personal individual reflection on their judgments and their decisions, there would, for me, be a shared reflection, because how you decide in that circumstance might be different because your context is slightly different. But the meta context, if you like, the fact that the complexity was high and the autonomy needed was high, then we would take this kind of decision. That's what we can standardize. That's what we can get some kind of a level of agreement on.
Fantastic.
Standardized autonomy is a phrase that I've been using quite a lot with the organizations that I'm working with at the moment. It's not either or.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Standardized autonomy. Okay. Definitely has me intrigued. I wonder though, if it's okay for me to ask a little bit more about things like Kinevin, for example. It's a decision-making framework, right? I know you are well-versed in that. And do you find that you also need to take the time to educate leaders and evolving leaders, emerging leaders, like specifically around Kinevin? Or do you bring up about the concepts without really having to go into a deep dive of Kinevin in and of itself? What are you finding is more useful?
So for me, I think most people can get some value from a surface level appreciation of Kinevin. Perhaps even without too much of the jargon. And then once they see that it's relevance, and they see actually it's a lot deeper than that, it's a lot more nuanced than that, then they're generally encouraged, they encourage themselves to self-study deeper. I'm not an academic in that I don't study something just for the sake of studying it, just for the pleasure of studying something. I study something because I want it to be useful. And I find a lot of leaders in a similar kind of way. They haven't got a huge amount of time to study hugely deep concepts. But if they find something useful to them and they know there's more there, then they will go deeper themselves. So I would talk to them about different kinds of decisions. I'd get them to plot a few decisions, think of a few decisions they've made recently, and say, well, in that situation, was that clear and obvious to everyone? Would everybody have made the same decision there? Or is there scope for some people experiencing it differently, perceiving it differently, might have made a different decision? And if it was there a process written for that? Is there a process written for that? Because if there isn't, then there's waste there. Mm. And those kinds of conversations. But for me, the most important part of the Kinevin conversation is the line and the liminality between the complicated and the complex, because that's where most leaders find it most difficult to know how to act and to counter a lot of their biases, because we can be very self-persuasive at times. We can rationalize something as, well, yeah, this requires expertise, this requires analysis, so well, let's analyze it, when actually probably should have run an experiment there, and vice versa. And that is the key thing between efficiency and effectiveness that most organizations struggle with.
Oh, wow. Brilliant. I want to highlight there just that you compared and contrasted there. Effectiveness and efficiency, was it? Did I hear that correctly? Yeah. Thank you for that. Really important. And that liminality, if I'm using the word that I heard you also say, that distinction between complexity or just something that's just kind of compound, complicated, But there's a distinction there.
Sort of a gray area, a blurring of the lines, that sort of contextualization. But the efficiency and effectiveness, I think, is key for me, because we've been brought up, we're kind of efficiency junkies, certainly in the West. Yes. And this idea that actually we've got to squeeze out any element of slack or waste and get the most bang for our buck, the highest yield, the, you know, the biggest return on our investment. And there's a huge amount of time when that is absolutely brilliant. But when product's lifespan is significantly shorter than it used to be, the amount of time where you can, when you've gone from making something, from selling something to make it to make to sell, and you're into that sort of late majority phase is significantly smaller than it used to be. You don't have as much time to generate those efficiencies that you used to, and before you have to adapt. And so the amount of time you need to get from exploiting the efficiencies back into being effective again and doing something differently that might make you a little bit of a loss, but it's the right thing to be doing, is such a critical thing for organizations that it goes against almost what they've been taught and what they've seen as successful and what organizational culture has valued in the past. Letting go of this efficiency drug.
Yes. Yes. It is that way. I find myself even in my daily life just trying to think of a more efficient way to to slice the celery before putting it in the snack baggies for a family member or something. It's like it's funny, but you're right. We are somewhat addicted to this desire for efficiency all over the place.
But that context, that example there, that is, efficiency is a good thing there.
Yeah.
Because you want to improve on something, and it's not an unknown. It's not something that, you know, your expertise is going to be harmful to you. It's not about completely innovating a new way. It's just about optimizing what you already. It's a relatively simple task, right? But there may be different ways to do it. And we have a lot of those. And if we can have the more of those that we can have, brilliant. But there are more and more examples where that is the wrong thing to do, and we get into. If making efficient the things that we shouldn't be doing.
Interesting. Yes. Wow. Making efficient the things we shouldn't be doing. Wow. What are you finding then? It's been a while since I've gone through the Team Mastery book, but I'm thinking about teams and this fact that we're trying to give more decision-making two teams, you know, they're at the area where the work occurs. And so I'm thinking about this concept now of teams hopefully not making themselves more efficient at something that they should not be doing, right? And the role of the Scrum Master in particular to try to help them see this. But something more on that kind of team context that you might want to highlight there for us to think about, and how leaders around the team can better foster their ability to make these better decisions.
Yeah. And I think that final part that you just added there, how leaders can help teams do this. And again, this idea of taking time out, which you said we do find quite difficult to do, but we need to take time out, step back. Retrospectives is something that's pretty common these days, but still it can be a lot more in the moment than that. But from a leadership perspective, I would want people to be aware that there are times when optimizing a process is a great thing. And there are times when actually changing the process is a good thing. And what are the fears associated with both of those types of approach? And how do we know? What are the triggers that could tell us in our context which is more likely to be? And how can we reduce the risks of some of those fears? So if I run an experiment on something that I shouldn't be running an experiment on because it's clear and obvious, it's just a case of optimizing it, then there's waste there. Because if I run multiple parallel experiments, which is what Ken Evan would ask us to do, then the majority of them, 90x% of them, will be waste because there will be one right answer ultimately. And I could probably have figured that out. But if there's waste there. But if I actually try and work out, analyze, use my expertise to figure out the answer when actually I should have been experimenting, that will be waste as well, because I will never get there. I'll just keep going, because there will always be more information, more unknowns creeping up. I'll never be able to find the answer. So either way is wrong. So this fear because we don't like getting things wrong. We don't like looking silly. We don't want to jeopardize, you know, social exclusion and judgment and all these kinds of things. We don't want to get it wrong. So how can I make it safe for people to potentially get it wrong? Now, for both of those situations, there are ways that you could mitigate it. But on the whole, what I see leaders saying is, well, if I was going to be wrong, if I knew I was going to be wrong, which way would I rather be wrong? And generally speaking, the safer, the lower risk thing is to experiment at the risk of experimenting with something that I could have worked out, as long as we get good at experimenting. Mm. Now, experimentation is a skill.
Yes,
so that's something that leadership, again, can role model. What is a good experiment? One that tries to take our cognitive biases out of the equation, one that's cheap, one that's replicable, one that offers multiple parallel outcomes, and can be amplified if it's going well and dampened if it's not going well. And modeling that and then helping people, you know, almost go back to science school, if you like, yeah. Set up some kind of laboratory mindset. Well, let's look at some good experiments. Let's look at some experiments that, you know, perhaps cost too much, were a bit too risky. And making it safe, this idea of psychological safety expands to this concept as well.
Love it. Yeah, and the leaders, as you said, role modeling that. And that helps me segue to some other questions I wanted to ask you regarding leaders and how they can role model experimentation. Is some of that connected to your particular reasons as to why you created, you've got your lessons for agile leaders, like a self-paced, helpful video lectures with activity worksheets and these excellent leadership affirmations, and then even suggestions for journaling. So it's brilliant. I love it. I'm going through it. But is that some of your purpose for creating that learning, is for leaders to figure out ways to role model and to do more experiments at these, say, higher ranking levels of the corporate organization that they sit within?
I suppose in a way. I mean, now you've got me thinking about it. Ultimately, yeah, so I think when basically the conscious reason behind that, there may have been other unconscious things going on as well, but for me, the conscious reason behind that is because time after time when I'm working with leaders, there will be some pretty common things that crop up. You know, yes, every organization is unique. They are. Every individual is unique, but we all have some pretty common traits. We all have some pretty common experiences, hopes, dreams, these kinds of things. And I think organizations are pretty similar as well. So the idea behind this is saying, well, do you know what? Over the years, there have been some pretty consistent things that have cropped up that when I work one-to-one with people, when I work with leadership teams, that I won't push my agenda, but I'm pretty sure at some point, I knew you were going to talk about that at some point. So rather than let them wait for that, I'll just put them out there and say, well, there's a good chance, I can't guarantee it, but there's a very good chance that at some point in the next few months, if you're really going for this organizational transition, this cultural change, that you will come up against resistance from people, for example. You will get you'll see more conflict. You will have the need to give and receive more and better feedback, for example. You'll have to show vulnerability. You'll have to show weakness in order to be a strong leader. These kinds of things. So putting it out and saying, well, I can only meet so many people, right? I can only coach so many people. I can't scale myself, and that's great. The world should be thankful. but you think, well, why should people not be aware of this kind of stuff just because, you know, I'm not speaking to them, or they haven't got access to another coach that's been there before? So the idea was to put it out there, and it's people can access it whenever they want, right? They don't have to engage a coach. They can watch it in their lunchtime. They can watch it at the weekends. They can book an hour out in their calendar and watch one of these things, and they can go back to it as well once they've forgotten about it, or in a couple of months' time, oh yeah, resistance, we did some on that, didn't we? Yeah, and I'm seeing some more now. Let's go back and refresh that one.
I love that. And I know you also were recently reflecting, I think, within the Agile Mastery community of folks that you've cultivated and are cultivating here, where you were talking about a conversation, I think, with Esther Derby or something to that effect, where more of the insights you had gained from her about this perception we have of resistance and or perceiving things that way. And yet it's really not resistance in and of itself. It's just people's lack of comfort. It's their fears. It's so many things, right? I don't want to give away all the excellent things that are in your course there for you. But yeah, it is very helpful to get that perspective that we need as leaders. So thank you for putting that together, making it so easily accessible and convenient for leaders to improve themselves, you know, on times that are convenient for them. I did want, if it's okay, could I highlight a couple of the affirmations that you share in that course? Because I just want to give people a little taste for just how wonderful these things are. So I've kind of been collecting my notes. And so Jeff has these affirmations in his Lessons for Leaders course, and he'll say just a few at the end of each little module, but things like, it's my job as a leader to let go of perfection and aim for good enough in the context. Another one that he has is, it's my job as a leader to be honest about the level of uncertainty and not pretend things are more certain than they actually are. So these are brilliant. I love these, Jeff, and I'm reviewing them. I find they're kind of helpful little meditations, you know, either to start the day or to pause on some break throughout the day and to just kind of ground myself as a leader into some of these affirmations. So brilliant stuff. Thank you for including that in your course.
No worries. I think they're really important because I often say to people, be careful what you say to yourself because you're listening.
Yes.
You know, if you think we speak to ourselves in our heads so much, we don't realize we're doing it, but the messages we're giving ourselves, or this has to be perfect, or I have to be perfect, or, you know, I can't fail, or I've got to be strong, or I've got to look like I know the answers, I can't be vulnerable. Those unspoken messages are being reinforced often over decades.
So true.
They become unconscious scripts that inform our behaviors. And so these affirmations are just meant to be verbalized and then repeated, because you need to start outweighing those unhelpful or limiting statements with these more helpful and equally true or more true affirmations.
Fantastic. So knowing that organizations like the one I'm privileged to be in at the moment have invested in agile coaches and trying to mobilize those coaches throughout the enterprise to, you know, to help teams, to help individuals, knowing that this is something that's happening out here, what would you offer to corporate leaders, kind of these executive leaders in these companies, to try to make them somehow more, I hope I don't say this wrong, but I'll just put it out there, more willing perhaps to invest their time in actually getting to know these coaches, maybe even having some sessions one-on-one with them and see what their coaching styles are like and maybe see if they benefit from it. I'm curious about that. I haven't yet found myself in actual conversations with some executives in our company. I'm working in that direction, but maybe both sides of the equation. What would you say if any executives happen to listen to the podcast? What would you offer to them? And then for coaches like myself that are listening in, what would you offer on that side of the equation to help them connect more and appreciate each other more?
So there's so much that I could potentially say on this. I'll try and try and take it one step at a time. So the first thing when it comes to the sort of willingness to engage, I think there's an element of rapport that needs to be built. And that rapport, in my experience, generally comes from neutrality. So if I'm an agile coach, and this is potentially a problem that agile coaches need to consider, is that by labeling themselves or being labeled an agile coach, if I'm a leader, I'm thinking, so you coach me in agile. That's what you do. Now, personally, I could do that, but organic agility isn't about creating an agile organization. Part of organic agility would be finding the parts of the organization that shouldn't be agile.
Yes.
So it's about making a more effective and resilient organization. Now, so that if I think somebody is potentially going to coach me and they've got an agenda, then I see that as either education about something that I have to admit I'm wrong about, or you're going to push your agenda. You're going to manipulate me to your way of thinking. It's not what you're intending, but that's how it could come across if you don't come across as neutral. If you feel you've got an agenda, there's an issue there. And the second aspect for me around the effectiveness of any kind of coaching is, well, what's in it for them? So it has to be of value to them, not me, ideally. Again, this ulterior motive, this agenda. So what I have to offer should be of value to them, not me. All right.
Right.
And that's, I think, where I've seen quite a lot of agile coaches come unstuck, because they come across as agile evangelists and saying, well, this, leadership, this is what you need to do. This is what the teams are telling us, right? The teams are trying to be agile. You say you want to be an agile organization. This is what you need to do. You need to admit you're wrong. You need to change what you're doing. You need to do this, because the teams need it, because your organization needs it. Well, what about me? What do I need? Why do you think I'm here as a leader? Do you think I'm here because I want the organization to fail? No, I want this organization to be successful, but I also want to be able to add value. I also want to feel worthwhile. I also want to feel like I'm fitting into this world. And how is this going to help me? And ultimately, the organization that I am leading, how is it going to help that? So I think framing the conversation that way and basically letting go of your attachment. And I think there was I was giving a talk on mindful product ownership at a Scrum gathering a few years ago. And someone in the crowd said, how has your teaching changed over the years? So I'd probably been teaching Scrum for 12 years, something like that. He said, which was an interesting question, given that the talk was around product ownership. It was a little bit out. Okay, interesting question. I had to think about it. Wasn't expecting that. And my instinctive response was, I care less. So I said, I care less, which sounded quite flippant. This is what, you just don't care anymore. So it's not that, but I used to teach because I wanted people to do what I was teaching. I would feel successful if they left thinking, right, I'm going to go back and I'm going to have a product backlog and I'm going to have an increment and we're going to get done every sprint and we're going to be cross-functional and the organization's going to change. That for me was success. And if I didn't get that, I'd feel failure. Now I don't feel that kind of responsibility that I need to get people to a state of actually making that action. I want people to make a more informed choice. I want people, if they come and they think, do you know what, this isn't for me, that's still success for me. And I think the same for coaching as well. Right. If actually they look at this and think, well, I now have the tools to understand my context. I now have the tools to make sense of what's going on. And my decision is this. And I've made this decision in a way that mitigates risk, that maximizes learning, that respects my values and the organization's values. Then the outcome will take care of itself. Not, I want this person to have left my coaching session thinking, I'm going to be more agile.
Brilliant. Yes. Wow. That's really, really helpful for me and I'm sure for many listeners. Thank you for also for sharing some more vulnerability there as you shared your thought process with that question you weren't expecting and then more of what it was revealing to you. So that's great. Yeah. So entering into a relationship with that neutrality, not like you're there with some agenda. It's hilarious to me, by the way, that you mentioned coming across like some agile evangelist. My current title is an agility evangelist, so I may have to rethink that now. But
don't take it personally.
But
I'm not trying to dig myself out of a hole here, but the strengths behind evangelism are around passion, around being able to spread things. But other people will have an adverse reaction to that word.
They will. I fully realize that too. So yeah, my intent, just for the listeners out there, my intent is the essence of it being about good news, kind of back to etymology of words. And my hope is to be about creating joy in the workplace and identifying these areas where leaders, teams, people are finding more joy because not just in efficiency, but in their effectiveness at decision-making and other things. So all these things Jeff has been helping expound upon today, trying to find ways to shine a spotlight when these good things are happening. Because I think when we do that and talk about that good news, it encourages other people in other areas of an organization to say, I'd like to have a bit of that. I want to go find out more about that. I want to talk to those people, or I could maybe benefit from a conversation with a coach who could get me moving in that direction. So what do you think about that, Jeff?
That just reminds me of, it's a slightly old fashioned thing. But it was certainly true at the time, and I think it's a good thing that it's not as true now. But the principles behind it, or the philosophy behind it, or the underpinning, I think it would be useful to know. So we used to talk about, or we discovered the golf course effect at BT. So sort of the old boys network, which thankfully isn't so much of a thing anymore. Yes. But you'd get these senior managers who would have their golf day, and they'd be talking about, basically bragging, my team managed to deliver a project that wasn't late for once, and didn't cost three times as much as it normally did. It was something to do with rugby. I don't know what it was. And then you get, literally, I got my boss was phoned up by another senior manager saying, apparently you do some kind of rugby development now, and it means it's cheaper and on time. I want some of that. It's not rugby, it's scrum. So I don't care what it is, if it's on time and it's cheaper, I want some. This sort of bragging, but also sort of one-upmanship, if you like, of, well, if they've got something good, then I want some of that. So creating those stories, and then being able to spread that thing, this for me brings me on to that it's a double prong thing, if you like, which is culture and stories, because I'm of the opinion that our organizational culture is essentially just the stories that we tell about what works here and what doesn't work here, and how things work and how things don't work. And over time, we start creating more stories of success based on different ways of working, but those stories need to be amplified and spread out and retold. That's without question, everywhere that I've been, that has been a huge part of the change.
Yes, and I'm so glad you highlighted storytelling in there. I'm seeing a lot more about leaders that are finding greater success because they've been able to tell stories well, share stories well, and help others share their own stories. And I think you've demonstrated that in your books, the way you weave in those anecdotal stories. Of what the Scrum Master, product owner, the team members are experiencing, even in your coaching book there, revealing what those supervisory conversations are like and the other coaching conversations in some story format. It's brilliant. And it's definitely been inspirational and motivational for me. So thank you again for how you do that in the world. It makes me wonder, by the way, This I hope we don't go too far off topic, but with your last name Watts, it just connected in my mind with Isaac Watts, a hymn writer of some centuries back now. But I wonder if you have a family connection. Anyway, it's don't know if you do genealogy type research, but
My grandmother does. But my grandmother on my mother's side, so follow the Watts line. She followed the Dickinson and the Moses and what have you. So I don't know. I've never really followed the Watts line back very far.
Yeah. Well, it popped in my mind. Interesting little connection there. But Jeff, this has been such a great conversation. Just a fun, insightful exploration of so many elements of what goes into being a great leader, a true agile leader. But as we highlighted earlier, it's not with the agenda of agile in and of itself. It's more of that organic way of growing and helping others grow. So I really appreciate you spending time with us today to go over more of some of that framework, related topics, elements of what you have in your courses for leaders. I wonder what final thoughts or any other information might be on your mind that you'd like to take a moment to share with our listeners out there.
I suppose the one thing that's just stuck in my mind that we didn't come back to, we very, very briefly touched on it, but I think it's quite important, is and I'm going to link together actually the thing that's come through a couple of times, which is evangelism. And there's a saying that you're never a prophet in your own land.
Yes.
And sometimes somebody outside your organization saying exactly the same thing as somebody inside your organization has a bigger impact, and sometimes vice versa. But the reason for bringing this up really is because I've found my ability to provide that sort of neutral coaching, that neutral sounding board, that no agenda as an external coach to be incredibly valuable. Because no matter how good an internal coach is, they're always part of the system. And there's always a part of me, if I'm that leader, I think being coached by another colleague, do they have an ulterior motive? Can they be neutral enough? Can they want me to be successful, or do they have other things that are pulling them, incentivizing them for different outcomes? Are they neutral enough to play this back rather than playing it back through the lens of the organization? And as much as I've seen the rise of leadership coaching throughout the organization, I've seen more and more of it. The other trend that I've seen is more and more of in-housing, and largely because it's cheaper. But also, if you're developing those coaching skills, why not use them internally? It makes a lot of sense in many ways. But having that neutrality, that clearly no agenda, I think is a huge advantage to the organisations that do keep with that. And it's tricky, but I think it's a really important part.
Oh. Yes, absolutely. No, thank you for that. Yes, it's not unlike maybe the family experience when family discord exists, but yet you have someone, maybe a extended relative that doesn't come around a lot, but they enter in, they've got a fresh set of eyes, they're bold enough to offer kind of that neutral perspective, and it can help the family work through whatever the problem may have been. Counselors, pastors, other kinds of people do the same type of thing, right? But yeah, brilliant. Thanks again for highlighting that. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you so very much for being my guest on the show today. This has been such a great conversation with you. I trust our listening audience out there will agree on how informative and inspirational all of this has been. Thank you again.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for spending time with us today. Please take a few moments to rate and review this podcast. If you would like to appear as a guest or have any questions or comments, it would be my privilege to quack about it with you. Send me an email at jeff@agilequawka.com. To learn more about our guests and any items we referenced within the podcast, visit the episode notes. To discover more about me, the Agile Quawka, visit my website at agilequawka.com. Until next time.